By December of 1923, the lives of Edgar, his family, and Gladys had undergone a remarkable change, not just due to the new type of readings, but to their lack of income. Instead of receiving a December check from J.B. Williams, who had taken over the Selma studio, Edgar received hundreds of dollars in bills for business and tax debts that his father, Leslie, had failed to pay on the Casey Art Company while Edgar was in Texas. And although Edgar had given 34 medical readings since coming to Dayton, the vast majority had been for friends and family of the people around him, for which he was not compensated. Nor had Edgar received compensation for giving life readings. Though Arthur Lammers had pledged to support him, Edgar hadn't received a single check. As Edgar told his family back in Hopkinsville, Christmas this year was going to be very thin. The little money that the Casey family had saved up to that point had gone to move Gertrude, Gladys, Edgar Evans, and their belongings to Dayton. Edgar and Gertrude's resources were so meager that Gladys hadn't been paid since before her arrival. Gertrude had been forced to use the last remaining gold coin from her dowry to raise cash to pay the train fare to bring Hugh Lynn home for the Christmas holidays. Despite the family's financial hardships, Edgar, Gertrude, and Gladys were in high spirits that Christmas Eve. Excitement was in the air, Hugh Lynn later reported, and the reason became clear when Gladys and the others began discussing the new kind of readings that the source was giving. Although no one, including Edgar himself, was entirely convinced of the truth of the information that was coming through, all were convinced that some major breakthrough had been made, and that the work would never again be confined to simply giving physical diagnosis and business-related readings. It was then that Hugh Lynn was given his Christmas present, the life reading that had been conducted on his behalf on December 10th. At first, Hugh Lynn was confused, for he had never heard the word reincarnation before. Nor did he understand the purported connection between the movement of the planets and human behavior. As he studied his own life reading and came to the part about Andrew, the disciple of Christ, Hugh Lynn's confusion became disbelief, then anger, and finally, outright disgust. He didn't just intellectually disagree with his own life reading, he had a visceral aversion to reading it. He demanded that no further readings of this kind be conducted, and that no one in the family mentioned that they had ever been done. As he himself later reported, he felt as if his world was crashing down around him. Despite Hugh Lynn's initial reaction to his Christmas present, and the fact that he kept the details of his own life reading a secret for many years, he would later make penetrating studies of these readings, and ultimately embrace them more than Edgar, Gertrude, Gladys, or any of the others. In fact, 10 years after receiving his first life reading, Hugh Lynn requested a series of readings, which became the most lengthy and comprehensive discourse the source gave on the topic. There was one question asked during this series that seemed most pressing to Hugh Lynn. Why is reincarnation necessary at all? The source answered at some length that man's consciousness is gained through what he does about the knowledge of what he is, in relation to that from which he came, and toward which he is going. The source also made it clear that the knowledge gained through life readings is not the same as specific memories from previous incarnations. According to the source, our forgetfulness of our previous lives is by design. This is not only for the purpose of maintaining free will, but for our own protection, because the conscious memories from earlier incarnations could potentially become a great burden. The memory that a person takes with him into a subsequent incarnation is more in the form of a lesson that has been learned, or remains to be learned. Unless that lesson makes for a better person, it has no lasting value. This is what the source referred to as karma, or the impact that one incarnation has on another. As Hugh Lynn sought to communicate to those who studied the life readings, karma was simply subconscious memory and not a matter of divine punishment, as popularly understood by many believers in reincarnation. The point that the source repeatedly stressed was that karma and man's knowledge of it has a purpose. As the source said, "To find that ye only lived, died, and were buried under the cherry tree in grandmother's garden does not make thee one whit better neighbor, citizen, mother, or father. But to know that ye spoke unkindly and suffered for it, and in the present may correct it by being righteous, that is worthwhile." Unquote. To Hugh Lynn, like Edgar, the central message being communicated was that life has purpose and direction, and that reincarnation could only be understood in the context of where man came from and where he is going, from the first cause, or God, and back to God. The primary object of all human experience, the source said, was to become a worthy companion to God. The great world around us is a matter of our own creation, and it allows us to see where we stand in our journey back to God. The vast majority of life readings and their accompanying physical readings suggested that karma was at the root of the challenges a person faced. Perhaps the most interesting example of karmic debt belonged to a woman who came to Casey suffering from gonorrhea. In her life reading, the source said she had once been a prostitute in Yokohama, and that in her present incarnation she had been infected by the same strain of venereal disease she had knowingly passed on to countless sailors a century and a half earlier. Although the focus in many of the readings was on what might be termed bad karma, the source devoted a greater number of readings to what might be called good karma, or talents, abilities, and attitudes that were earned as a result of having successfully met challenges in previous life experiences. A good person would be given greater responsibilities, which came in the form of wealth, station in life, good health, or highly developed abilities and talents. The source described these earthly blessings as responsibilities, because they, too, were karmic and had to be used in a manner that was in keeping with the divine purpose. As Edgar's own life reading would later reveal to him, his most special blessing, his ability to communicate on a psychic level, was a direct result of his soul development in previous lifetimes. By virtue of his special task in life, Edgar, like many others who obtained life readings for themselves, drew to himself people and groups of people with whom he had previously associated in prior incarnations. According to the source, groups of people could incarnate together to work out individual karma or complete some long-term good that had been started in previous incarnations. As Edgar gradually became aware while conducting the first series of life readings, the people in close contact with him invariably knew one another in Egypt many thousands of years earlier, which was where the work had truly begun. The Casey's financial situation was becoming more dire. Edgar still believed that Arthur Lammers would provide the financial support he had repeatedly promised. However, by January 1924, Lammers' businesses went into bankruptcy. Looking back on those early months of the new year, Hugh Lynn remembered that he could see the hurt look in his father's eyes when he talked about people who had disappointed him. But about money, his father simply said, "It will come." The truth of the matter, however, was that the family was flat broke. They, along with Gladys Davis, were now stranded in a city of strangers during what was described as one of the coldest winters in Dayton's history. The only income the family received was from medical readings, which were being conducted on an average of one per day. They would have liked to have given more readings, but no one besides their small circle of supporters knew who they were or what Edgar did. Having devoted the lion's share of his trance time to life readings, he hadn't developed contacts with the medical community or established the base of support that he'd had in Birmingham and Nashville. Income from doing a daily physical reading, billed at a rate of $5 per session, barely put food on the table. A brief comment that Edgar made in a letter to a friend that they were still eating sometimes was not the joke it appeared to be. Physical readings conducted for Gertrude repeatedly warned of complications due to vitamin and mineral deficiencies in her diet. In the midst of this abject poverty, Edgar gave some of the most inspired and provocative readings of his career. The most notable was the life reading he finally gave himself on February 9th. Due to the sheer amount of information that the source had to provide, the reading was continued over a period of 7 days. The introductory statements to Edgar's reading were similar to those made by the source for dozens of life readings over the years. The source said it would give only the information that would be vital to Edgar at the time, and also indicated that it treated Edgar with the same neutrality accorded other recipients of life readings. Though others no doubt put Edgar on a pedestal, the source clearly stated the challenges that he confronted were those of an ordinary man. In the reading, Edgar was described as one given to make manifest in the present plane much of the forces of psychic and occult forces, reaching the greater height of developing in such plane, one that will bring, through such manifestations, joy, peace, and quiet to the masses and multitudes through individual efforts. The next part of his reading, dedicated to vocation, appeared to be offering Edgar a choice of possible careers. It suggested that he could do virtually anything that he willed, but that his work in the field of psychic research would be best. The source said, "The better condition would be toward those of psychic and occult, or teaching or developing along the lines of such plane to give the manifestation of such forces to the populace." The remainder of the reading described Edgar's previous incarnations. Casey was currently in his 8th life on Earth. His last incarnation had been as a British soldier named John Bainbridge, who was born in Cornwall, England, and received military training in Canada. His life as John Bainbridge ended when he drowned in the river during a battle near Dayton. The source described another incarnation, of short duration, in the French courts, during the rule of Richelieu. The fact that the source had previously told both Gertrude and Gladys that they, too, had lived in France around this time suggested that the three had somehow been connected during this period. But, as Edgar would soon discover, the source was reluctant to expand on exactly what had happened. Either the source did not deem this information to be necessary, or, as Edgar himself later concluded, didn't think Casey was prepared to hear what the source had to say. The source also described Edgar's incarnation in Egypt during the dynasty of the Ramesses, when Hugh Lynn was said to have been a pharaoh, and Edgar was the high priest Ra-Ta. As a result of what the source characterized as an inappropriate liaison between Edgar and Gertrude, who also lived during this time, the pharaoh banished them from Egypt. According to Gladys's life reading, she had also lived in Egypt during this era, although for only a short period of time. Her relationship to Edgar and Gertrude, and the karma associated with it, was a subject the source would not elaborate upon at this time. Edgar's reading highlighted the need for all of them, Edgar, Gertrude, Gladys, and Hugh Lynn, to head off to the Dayton Public Library to gain a better understanding of world history and geography. The fact that the readings thus far hadn't contradicted the known facts of textbook history made their research into the story of their past lives all the more rewarding. Nor would their readings be definitively contradicted by later scholarly research. In fact, the more the readings were studied, the more accurate they appeared to be. It was in a vein of historical self-discovery that the life readings continued at an ever-increasing pace. The fact that the source had piqued Edgar, Gertrude, and Gladys's interest in their past personal relationships made what they would hear next all the more disturbing. On May 31st, 1924, Gladys decided to have a second life reading. Several months had passed since Edgar had given the first life readings for his own family, and the possible connections between their previous incarnation had been discussed often. And yet, the most perplexing mystery still remained: how an 18-year-old girl arriving late into Edgar and Gertrude's life had become such an important catalyst to the process of giving deeper, more meaningful life readings. The first incarnation the source elaborated on in Gladys's follow-up reading was her French incarnation as the second daughter of Louis XIV. At age 17, she was reportedly seduced by the philandering Duke of York, who later became King James II of England. Gladys became pregnant and gave birth to none other than Edgar Casey in his fifth incarnation. Here, the story becomes tragic. Gladys's mother, the Queen, reportedly lost favor with King Louis, who banished her and her daughter and grandchild from court. To protect her child from the king's vengeance, Gladys left Edgar in the care of close friends in the household of the king. The child was discovered and killed by the king, and Gladys subsequently died of a broken heart. This reading went on to say, "The affection which was lost in that plane should be manifest in this present incarnation, for Gladys Davis will only find its rest in this earth's plane with that entity, Edgar Casey." A crucial piece of the incarnation puzzle had now been revealed. Based on this reading, Gladys's entry into the lives of the Caseys was far more than a coincidence. It explained why she had stayed with Edgar in Dayton, despite the fact that she hadn't received a paycheck and had to share a bedroom with two adolescent boys. The reading also explained why Gladys seemed to be the only stenographer in Edgar's life who could record his trance discourses with the seeming familiarity of a mother listening to her son. Edgar must have been just as intrigued as Gladys, for he went back into trance that same day to ask the source about his French incarnation and his relationship to Gladys. The source said of Edgar and Gladys, "The lives of each have ever been bound in the other's life, and that they find in each the answering chord in the other's affection that will never, never, never be found in any other." The reading went on to advise, "Be faithful one to the other, irrespective of earthly conditions. Be kind, affectionate, loving, ever giving, ever preferring the other." By ever preferring the other, the source appeared to be saying that they, by necessity, must always put the other first, ahead of themselves. The statement that these two had always been together obviously prompted both wonder and curiosity. Just 2 days later, another reading on this subject was conducted. The first question asked was about the specific nature of previous connections between Gladys and Edgar. The source replied that Edgar Casey and Gladys Davis have had many experiences together, and their soul and spirit are well knit, and must of necessity present each that they may be one. For we find in the beginning that these two were as one in mind, soul, spirit, body, and in the first earth's plane as the voice over many waters, when the glory of the Father's giving of the earth's indwelling of man was both male and female in one. Gladys may already have begun to suspect some strong previous relationship with Edgar Casey, but this new information presented a challenge the likes of which neither she nor Edgar could begin to comprehend. 19-year-old Gladys Davis was being told something that might otherwise have been a romantic dream come true. Her female soul had once been a single entity with another male soul in some distant realm or dimension. That soulmates through time did exist, and that she had found her soulmate. The nightmare was the fact that her soulmate was a happily married man, 27 years her senior, wedded to a woman whose friendship she had come to cherish. Also, this man, according to the source, had to remain married because of the karma that he and his wife had created in Egypt with Yu Lin. In other words, Edgar and Gertrude were meant to be together in their present incarnation, and Gladys and Edgar would have to wait until their next incarnation to be reunited. The mixed blessing of both knowing her soulmate, but being unable to enter into a full marital relationship with him, was a subject that Gladys, at this point and for years to come, declined to discuss with anyone besides Edgar and Gertrude. And yet, the stress that came as a result of that knowledge could neither be concealed nor dismissed. In one physical reading after another, the source recommended that Gladys undertake exercises, meditation, and therapy to combat depression and other physical problems stemming from mental stress and sexual repression. Edgar, too, felt the burden of knowing Gladys was his soulmate. Emotionally, he may have loved her as a wife, but he could only treat her as a daughter at best and in her role as his secretary. This knowledge also created stress in his marriage to Gertrude. He had a wife in the flesh, whom he clearly loved, and with whom he had deep-rooted connections. Now, in his young secretary, he had a wife in the spirit, who ultimately would be his mate into eternity. How long it took Edgar to discuss this subject with Gertrude is unclear. The conversation, wherever it took place, must have been both awkward and uncomfortable. Any strain that might already have been felt between Gertrude and Gladys would have been exacerbated by this revelation, whether they truly believed it or not. This much was clear to them. The present circumstance that Edgar, Gertrude, and Gladys found themselves in was karmic, and how each of them chose to handle it would determine their future challenges or blessings to come. In subsequent readings, Gladys and Edgar repeatedly sought trance advice as to how to deal with this awkward and potentially volatile situation. The source went as far as to suggest that a physical union between Edgar and Gladys, if handled discreetly, would not be inappropriate if they so desired, and would enhance their unity. Based on the questions posed in subsequent readings, and information that Gladys herself later confided to Jeanette Thomas, the archivist who carried on Gladys's work with the readings, Edgar and Gladys made a conscious decision to abstain from any carnal experience. This was corroborated by a medical examination performed on Gladys shortly after Edgar's death, when Gladys was about to undergo treatment for uterine cancer. As her personal physician's report indicated, Gladys Davis, at age 55, was still a virgin. Their choice was not an easy one. It was made all the more difficult because anyone who knew of their true connection would naturally have questioned the nature of their close personal relationship. And even those who didn't study the readings sometimes reached their own conclusions about what they perceived as a young, pretty, unmarried secretary living with and working for a charismatic psychic. The fact that Gladys didn't date or was otherwise unavailable to the local male population only magnified their suspicions. If Gladys had been considering bailing out on the Caseys in Dayton and returning home to Alabama, she now had a most compelling reason to stay. Edgar Casey's work, the work that had begun thousands of years before, was also her own. As the family became better established in Dayton, discussions once again turned to forming a Casey Institute, where readings could be conducted and studied on a more formal basis. Despite the fact that Edgar didn't know where the institute would finally be located, or how it would be financed, he was more impatient than ever to establish a more stable base of operations. As Edgar said to George Klingensmith, he did not want to be forever ding-donging everyone for a few shekels to get along. Frustrated at the lack of success in his oil endeavors, Edgar now went searching for a business manager. It was the source who helped Edgar Casey narrow his search. In a reading on August 13, 1924, the source named several people suited to be his manager, including Morton Blumenthal, a 29-year-old Jewish stockbroker from New York who was a friend of Dave Kahn's. Despite the fact that Edgar had never met Blumenthal, he appeared to have all the right credentials. According to Kahn, he was young, well-educated, much admired in the financial community, and had a burning desire to understand the secrets of the universe. There were many people Edgar Casey loved and admired throughout his career. But more than anyone else in Casey's life, Morton Harry Blumenthal combined the leadership skills and grand vision of a corporate executive with a deep passion for truth and the courage to stand by his convictions. As Edgar later said, he never admired another man as much as he did Morton. And Morton, in turn, never gave more of his time and resources to someone outside his own family than he did to Edgar Cayce. Morton and his brother Edwin were men of considerable means and influence, and Conn believed they could do great things for the work, if only he could engage them in a business deal. Conn piqued Morton's interest in Edgar to the point that Morton proposed to pay for Edgar to make a trip to New York, along with giving him a modest stipend to cover household expenses while he was gone. Edgar traveled to New York on October 4th to meet with Morton. Morton was everything that Dave Conn had said he would be, and more. The handsome, dark-haired stockbroker had a philosopher's love of beauty and the arts, and a businessman's practical approach to life. Morton was impressed by Edgar's stories of his childhood in Beverly and his partnership with Ketchum and No, though he later admitted to being put off by Edgar's obvious lack of education and his slow Kentucky drawl. At the end of Edgar's 10-day visit, on October 14th, Dave Conn would conduct the first of what would be four life readings on Morton. The reading stated that Morton would have much worldly goods, though how he chose to use those goods would determine whether or not they would remain in his possession. Regarding previous incarnations, Morton was described as having once been the great mythic figure of Achilles, who led the Greek army's assault on the city of Troy. The source also mentioned one other of Morton's incarnations, that of a sage in an Egyptian religious cult who became an important advisor to the king. As would later become evident, Morton's Egyptian incarnation and his incarnation as Achilles coincided with Edgar, Gertrude, Hugh Lynn, and Gladys's prior incarnations. He, too, had been part of the work since the beginning. And a later reading would reveal that he, like his brother Edwin, had been one of the little folk, Edgar's imaginary friends, who appeared not just for Edgar's amusement, but to help prepare him for his life's work. Not long after Edgar's trip to New York, Morton visited Dayton. When he arrived by train on November 2, 1924, Morton couldn't have been more stunned by the dichotomy of the Cayces' existence in Dayton. Though Edgar was giving readings for some of the city's wealthiest families, the Cayces were living in what Morton described as sheer poverty. Morton simply couldn't believe that a man with such obvious talents would live in such squalid conditions. After visiting Dayton, Morton invited Edgar, Gertrude, Hugh Lynn, Edgar Evans, and Gladys to be his guests in New York. During his stay, Edgar gave readings for Morton's mother, Frieda Blumenthal, his brother Edwin, Edwin's wife, Ruth, and Adeline Levy, the woman who would become Morton's wife. Based on the success of these readings, Blumenthal decided to devote much of his time and energy to Edgar, not as a manager, as suggested in the readings, but as his benefactor. He put Edgar on a retainer of $50 a week. Subsequently, Edgar was expected, but not obligated, to give readings for Morton and his brother Edwin, and later for his wife. Gladys would be paid $25 a week for transcribing the readings and handling communications between New York and Dayton. The assumption that Dave Conn made was that the Blumenthals wanted Edgar to give readings on the stock market, and indeed Edgar did. But intrigued by the apparent knowledge the source had exhibited, Morton also had something much grander than the financial world in mind. He wanted readings on the life of Jesus Christ. Cayce's readings had already suggested the exalted position with which the source viewed the life and teachings of Jesus Christ. References to the lowly Nazarene, the Master, and the Prince of Peace appeared thousands of times during trance sessions in ways that suggested that the reading's recipients should aspire to a greater understanding of God. Now that Morton Blumenthal's curiosity had been piqued by his own life reading, he naturally wanted to know if Jesus, the man, actually existed, and if the accepted details of his life, as put forth in the Bible, were accurate. The fact that Morton Blumenthal, who was Jewish, first raised the subject made the search for the historical Jesus all the more unusual. To Edgar's relief, rarely did the contents of what became known as the Jesus readings overtly contradict what appeared in the Bible. More often than not, these readings added clarity and drew a deeper, more three-dimensional picture of the life and times of Jesus Christ. Perhaps the most intriguing information that came through Casey concerned the preparation for the Messiah's birth, a topic on which the Bible provides few details. In a particularly fascinating discourse on biblical history, the source suggested that preparations for the coming of the Messiah were underway 400 years before the birth of Jesus. According to Casey, the group of people who were preparing the way and in whose midst Jesus was eventually born were the Essenes, or the Brotherhood. Casey described them as a non-celibate religious order within Jewry, whose primary function was as record keepers, interpreters of the prophecies, and channels for the Messiah to come. For modern historians, the Essenes have long been an enigma, primarily because there is little mention of the sect's existence after the birth of Jesus. Much of what is now known about the Essenes comes from the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were discovered in 1947, more than a decade after Casey first discussed the Essenes, and 2 years after his death. The information revealed by the Dead Sea Scrolls bears a striking similarity to the descriptions from Casey's readings, and provides the single most compelling evidence that the biblical history as presented by Casey might indeed be true. Over the years, the information that came through Casey about Jesus, his followers, and the early Christian church was enough to fill several volumes. How many historians have consulted this material is unknown. But for Edgar, Gertrude, and Gladys, who shared a deep feeling of love and reverence for the Master, the Jesus readings, which grew in depth and scope on an almost daily basis, became a means to better understand the often confusing lessons taught in the Bible. Perhaps more important, they became the catalyst for a greater and more intimate relationship with their Maker. For Morton, the Jesus readings were enough to bring about a cathartic experience. A practicing Jew, Morton would convert to Catholicism. He would also devote his considerable financial skills to lifting Casey out of poverty and building the hospital dedicated to his healing arts. Of all the people who showed an interest in working with Edgar and in forming the Casey Institute, Morton Blumenthal was the only one who urged him to listen to the source. And in terms of where Casey should carry on the work, Morton was emphatic, saying, "If the readings say Virginia Beach, then that's where you should go." In the late spring of 1925, Morton increased Edgar and Gladys's regular salary, promised to rent them a house in Virginia Beach, and provided $1,000 to get them there. Morton's grand gesture was much appreciated, though it would be several months after Hugh Lynn and Edgar Evans had finished out their school year that Gladys and the Caseys finally left for what from then on became known simply as the beach. By October 19, 1925, the move was complete, and all of them seemed to find their new accommodations quite to their liking. Having spent the last 2 years squeezed into a hotel room, and later a one-bedroom flat, and then a three-bedroom apartment, they felt a real sense of joy at finally having a home for themselves, even if it seemed they were all alone in this isolated environment. A summer tourist destination, Virginia Beach was a virtual ghost town in the winter. In retrospect, it is interesting that the source suggested that the Caseys move to such a deserted part of the country, where their social contacts were primarily supporters and friends who had to travel a long way to visit them. It was easy for the family to lead lives of relative seclusion at the beach, outside of the public eye, and where Gladys and the Caseys could better focus on what the readings were teaching them. For the most part, these early Virginia Beach readings were for Morton and his brother Edwin, who, as promised, were paying all of the family's bills. Readings for the Blumenthals were the first order of business each day, and the last to be discussed each evening. The Blumenthals would invariably ask about the rising and falling stock market, personal relationships, medical concerns, and for further information on Jesus Christ and other spiritual topics. However, soon after the Casey's arrival in Virginia Beach, Morton began asking the source to interpret his family's dreams, most specifically those relating to his and his new wife Adeline's unborn child. As Morton had been told back in Dayton, pay more attention to dreams, for this is where truths are given. Although Morton and Edgar had experimented with doing dream readings as early as January 1925, it was not until June and July of that same year, in the midst of doing the life readings, that the first series of dedicated dream readings were conducted. Ultimately, Edgar gave 800 readings to interpret over 1,600 dreams. Although 70 different people requested and obtained trance interpretations of their dreams, 90% of these readings were for four people: Edgar, Gladys, Morton, and Edwin Blumenthal. Casey's dream readings suggested that dreams were to be interpreted through signs, direct messages, and symbols. All of these were derived from an indelible record registered in the subconscious mind of the dreamer, and were composed of everything that the dreamer had seen, read, heard, imagined, or experienced in their present life or previous lives. In other words, the language and imagery of an individual's dreams were derived from his personal soul record and, as such, spoke only to that person. The dream's message, however, came from a higher self, or the higher selves of others. According to the source, messages could come from the grocery clerk at the market down the street, deceased family members, or divine communications sent to protect or guide an individual. Understanding the message was only a matter of keeping the channel open, or recognizing that it existed in the first place. Apart from the dream's message, the source identified nearly 200 different symbols that often had one particular meaning. An arrow, for example, was a portent of an incoming message. A baby or newborn child represented a new business venture or activity. Ultimately, however, all symbols represented what the dreamer made of them. The relevance of a vineyard to one person could be the same as a school classroom to another. Frequently, dream readings involved people close to a dreamer who had passed on, and who used the dream state as a direct means of communicating with loved ones. This was apparently the case with a dream Gertrude had in early October 1926, in which Edgar's mother, Carrie, was showing Gertrude through her house in Hopkinsville. As they walked through the rooms, Gertrude noticed that all the curtains in the windows were white. Eventually, Carrie led Gertrude through an underground passage. The subsequent trance reading stated that the white curtains and the underground passage were an indication that someone, presumably Edgar's mother, would soon be buried, that this person was re-entering the stream of life and returning again to the first element. Carrie Casey did indeed die later that month, on October 25, 1926. Edgar, who received a wire from his sister Annie that his mother was seriously ill, traveled back to Hopkinsville and was with Carrie when she died. Convinced of the good that could come from dream interpretation, Morton Blumenthal requested readings on dreams that he and his wife were having about their soon-to-be-born son, Morton Jr. Premonitions of the birth of a son first appeared to Adeline in a dream she had on June 29, 1925, in which a weak-minded boy or child appeared to her. A reading was conducted on July 1. Casey, in trance, cautioned her to be extremely careful about controlling her thoughts, for the projection of those thoughts would be translated into the physical. By dwelling upon negative thoughts, she might indeed have a weak-minded child. Adeline, with Morton's help, tried to maintain a positive attitude during her subsequent pregnancy, and many readings were conducted to help her overcome one crisis after another. First, there was the sudden illness of a longtime friend, then the sudden death of her mother, and finally the suicide of her father, all within a period of 9 months. Morton and Adeline's baby, which was born on April 4, 1927, was fair-skinned, had blue eyes and blonde hair, and would grow up to be bright, lively, and given to mischief. But, as the reading had warned, the child was weak-minded. Morton Jr. developed psychological problems that would later result in his confinement to a mental asylum. Morton and Edwin Blumenthal remained a constant presence in the daily lives of the Casey family. They not only paid Edgar a stipend and covered Hugh Lynn's tuition and expenses at college, they sent regular payments to Gladys and made the Caseys' lives in Virginia Beach more secure and happy than at any other point in their lives. Most important to Edgar, however, by the spring of 1926, the Blumenthals made their first serious attempts to raise the funds necessary to build the hospital. Morton's plan was to raise an initial $50,000 from the nearly 1,200 names on the association mailing list that Gladys had been preparing since their days in Dayton, and then to raise an additional $100,000 from other sources. Toward this end, application cards were printed offering various types of membership in what they called the Association of National Investigators. The first mailing went out in July 1926. In certain respects, the campaign was considered a success, for it resulted in the association becoming something more than just a mailing list. An organization was in place that had a permanent address, a standardized set of rules and procedures, and a plan for the future. The creation of a hospital where all members could receive the kinds of treatments recommended in the readings. From a fundraising point of view, though, the mailing was a dismal failure. 49 people contributed a total of $5,500. Undaunted by the initial response, Morton put another plan into action. He and his brother would use trance advice from their business readings to establish a dedicated stock market account, the profits from which would be used to buy property and begin construction of the hospital. Morton's thinking was that once the members saw an actual building going up, they would contribute larger amounts that would defray the association's initial expenses. And once the hospital was built and operating, the patients themselves would support its continuance. The idea was warmly received, if for no other reason than that the Blumenthal brothers themselves had successfully used the trance advice to triple their own stock market holdings. Perhaps the most impressive aspect of the more than 200 stock market readings that were subsequently conducted was Casey's astonishing trance ability to provide specific, detailed trading information. Casey, in trance, could apparently quote figures on the daily stock market as if he were a ticker tape machine with a direct line to the floor of the New York Exchange. In addition to the daily market indicators, the source frequently mentioned the names and agendas of various CEOs and major shareholders whose actions would determine a particular stock's performance. In September of 1926, for example, the source indicated that the Ford Motor Company would attempt to take over the management of Hudson Motors, and that Hudson Motors stock would respond accordingly, which did, in fact, happen. Perhaps the least understood and most misrepresented aspect of these readings was that Casey's higher self was not the primary source for the market information. A host of other entities introduced themselves through Casey to provide specific information. These entities were mainly the voices of four deceased souls: Morton's father, August Blumenthal, Marcus Lowe, Albert H. Gary, and Felix Fuld. All of these men, with the exception of Morton's father, had once been major international business or financial leaders. In more than two-thirds of the stock market readings, Casey, in trance, was not requested to report directly on a stock's performance, but asked to interpret performance based on Morton or Edwin's dreams. The purpose of such readings, according to the source, was not to interfere or give one individual an unfair advantage over another. It was to help Morton and Edwin develop their own intuitive abilities as they applied them to their lives and their work. Unfortunately, the loss of the Blumenthal trading records during the Great Depression makes it impossible to now determine exactly what percentage of their income came directly from recommendations made in the readings. But a review of the trance advice given to the Blumenthals in readings conducted between September 1924 and October 29, 1929, the period from which the first business requests were made to when the stock market suddenly crashed, is impressive by any standards. The record shows that the vast majority of stocks and bonds performed as described. Some of the Blumenthal holdings had growth well beyond the normal expectations in the bull market of the late 1920s. However, it should also be noted that the source's daily predictions, in which the voices were asked to cite the trading prices of a particular stock, were wrong by at least 1 to 2 points in nearly three-quarters of the cases studied. This was apparently not viewed by the Blumenthals as a failure, but rather as a result of the source's acknowledged inability to predict specific daily performance, based on changing market conditions. The market was determined by man's collective will, and even God could not predetermine the will of man. It is interesting to note that Edgar himself took little personal or professional interest in the stock market readings. He didn't study the rising and falling markets, and left all financial decisions regarding his own holdings in the hands of Morton. Feeling compelled to broaden his base of support, and unable or unwilling to let the Blumenthal stock market readings entirely determine the fate of his dream to build the hospital, Edgar launched his own initiatives designed to generate income. These efforts were to locate hidden petroleum deposits, as he had done hundreds of times in the past, to find buried treasure, and to patent various inventions. One treasure-hunting endeavor brought Edgar to the Caribbean island of Bimini, where, according to the source, a vault of buried treasure containing nearly 120,000 gold coins was hidden. Unfortunately, although Edgar gave 4 readings on the island, the gold and silver were never found, nor could the landmarks in the readings be located. However, although treasure had not been found, there was one unexpected reward that came from Casey's readings on Bimini. An exact geographical location of the mythical continent of Atlantis. Details on the lost continent of Atlantis had been mentioned in the very earliest life readings. But until Edgar's trip to Bimini, no one involved with the work thought of Atlantis as a specific place, a former continent now vanished under the sea. In a reading conducted on March 2, 1927, the source said that a temple of the Poseidians was once located near what was now the island of Bimini. This comment marked the beginning of what would become a lengthy, intensive inquiry into the subject, and led to the compilation and study of 600 life readings that made reference to Atlantis, Poseidia, or Alta, as the readings variously called the now lost continent. 14-year-old Edgar Evans Casey could take some of the credit for inspiring the committee to begin their research. It was his life readings that first detailed events in the mythic Atlantean kingdom, and suggested both the grandeur and tragedy of Atlantis's history. And just as Hugh Lynn came to embrace his own life reading and eventually devoted himself to a book-length study of reincarnation, Edgar Evans, in the years ahead, became the association's most adept student of the Atlantis readings. He eventually published his own book on the subject. No evidence exists to suggest that Casey's group made an effort to corroborate the source's depiction of Atlantis. Not until Edgar's death did Hugh Lynn and Edgar Evans launch a search along these lines, and their findings were generally dismissed as pseudo-archaeology or New Age science. This is the end of Side 6. Edgar Casey, an American prophet, continues on the next tape, Side 7.